Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
There's nothing like sinking into luxury. At washablesofas.com, you'll find the Anabe sofa, which combines ultimate comfort and design at an affordable price. And get this, it's the only sofa that's fully machine washable from top to bottom, starting at only $699. The stain-resistant performance fabric slipcovers and cloud-like frame duvet can go straight into your wash, perfect for anyone with kids, pets, or anyone who loves an easy-to-clean, spotless sofa. With a modular design and changeable slipcovers, you can customize your sofa to fit any space and style. Whether you need a single chair, love seat, or a luxuriously large sectional, Anabe has you covered. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your home. Right now, you can shop up to 60% off store-wide with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Add a little to your life. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Welcome back to Truth and Justice. Last week, we broke down the crime scene at the house on 10th Avenue. We walked through the testimony and evidence step by step, trying to piece together what happened that night. This week, we're shifting our focus to a new location, a baseball field or a ballpark at 14th Avenue and Idaho Street, where another disturbing discovery was made in the afternoon on February 17th in the year 2000, about 12 hours after the discovery at the house on 10th Avenue. As I've been continually saying, right now, we're not assuming any connection between the two scenes. Instead, we're going to look at each one individually, letting the evidence guide us, and only later will we consider whether they might be linked. The structure for this episode is going to follow a similar path to last week. In the first segment, we're going to hear from the man who first stumbled upon the ballpark scene and then give you the perspective of the first police officer to arrive. After that, we're going to take a deeper dive into the crime scene investigators and the medical examiner's testimonies to build a fuller picture. And then finally, just like last week in the last segment, I'm going to put it all together to form a hypothesis about what I think might have happened at the ballpark that night. Now, with that being said, I want to stress the fact that we are going to be revisiting these two crime scenes in later episodes. This was always the plan, but the necessity became pretty obvious during my research and writing of these last two episodes. Everything you heard last week and everything you're going to hear today is what the jury heard at Chris's trial. Now, this week, I am going to go into a little more detail because things were so vague during trial that I can't even paint a clear picture of this scene to you only using that testimony. But what I won't be doing in this episode is digging super deep into my analysis of crime scene photos, into forensics, into evidence that was discovered later. All of that's going to come at a later time. I want you guys to hear what the jury heard, because this is how Chris Bynum was convicted. Our story begins with Terrell Tiggs Sr., a 54-year-old Gary resident who was out walking his dog that Thursday afternoon. Triggs lived in Gary his entire life, and on February 17th, he decided to take his dog to the ballpark at 14th and Idaho Street, a familiar spot for a daytime stroll. He arrived around 11 or 12 p.m., which is the time he just kind of bases on his routine at trial. He doesn't really know. As he walked his dog around the field, he approached the east side near a fence line. And that's where things took an unexpected turn. The park should have been empty. There shouldn't have been anyone there. It's wintertime. But Triggs noticed a car on the other side of the fence, and his dog started barking. He was curious, so he went through a gate to get a closer look. Quote, I walked near the car and the dog kept barking and nobody raised up. So I looked past the car where there was like some bricks. And beyond the bricks, there was clothes laying, body and some clothes. End quote. And that was his first glimpse that something terrible had happened here. He had found a body partially visible beyond the car, surrounded by scattered clothing. Triggs didn't approach too closely. He stayed near the car, which he believed was a Ford Tempo. And from that distance, he could see part of a body, but couldn't determine if anyone was alive. He noted, quote, I just saw it. I could see part of the body from where I was near the car, end quote. His attention then shifted to the ground, where he observed a trail of blood. He described it as, quote, a road that goes along there, and there was a trail of blood going along that trail, and there was a trail of blood going back up into the bushes, end quote. The blood trail, of course, suggests movement, possibly someone or something being dragged. But at trial, Triggs didn't speculate on what it meant. Said he tied his dog to the fence, then untied it, and left the same way he came, avoiding the road and sticking to the fence line. After leaving, he went home, told his wife, and called the police. His discovery set the stage for the official response. But at that point, Triggs had no further involvement. Okay, before I jump to the first arriving officers, I want to give you a mental image of the layout of the ball field. Again, you're much better off to go to our website and look at the aerial photos and diagrams. But for those of you that are driving or at the gym or mowing the lawn, I'm going to do my best to paint this picture for you. So this is what we're dealing with. Idaho Street runs north and south, and it dies into 14th Street on the south end. 14th Street runs east and west. So imagine if you're driving south on Idaho Street. When you get to the end of the street, you either have to turn left or east onto 14th, or you can continue south off the road into the ball field property. Once you get onto the ball field property, there's about 150 feet of open grass area, probably used for parking during games. If you walked a straight line south from the intersection of 14th and Idaho, you'd come to the ball field first baseline fence at right around first base. The first baseline runs east and west, parallel to 14th Street. So home plate of the baseball field is located about 90 feet east of the intersection and 150 feet south of 14th. The third baseline of the field continues south from home plate, and there's a fence that surrounds the entire field. So that chain link fence runs from home plate all the way out to the left field corner. And again, the fence runs north to south. There's also a dugout between home plate and third base that will become relevant later. Along that fence, there's not really a road, but definitely a worn-down area where cars drive the length of that fence. So again, running north to south, you have the fence on the perimeter of the field. To its east and running parallel is a roadway, which Triggs referred to as a road. Now, that roadway is about 30 feet or so wide, and to the east of it is woods. And that's where the bodies were found, in those woods, which is, again, east of the fence around the field. So quite a distance from the road. Remember, if you drive off road around 150 feet to get to home plate, then you continue south all the way out to the outfield area before you get far enough from the road to get to the bodies. Now, Triggs was walking his dog inside of the fence, and that's when he noticed the car and went through a gate to investigate. Hopefully, that gives you a decent idea of what the scene looks like. And if you don't know anything about baseball, again, go look at the photos on our website. Now let's get into the initial response. The first police officer to arrive was John Kouros, a 3.5-year veteran of the Gary Police Department. Kouros received a dispatch call and arrived at the ballpark with his partner, Officer Galinas. Though the exact time of arrival isn't specified in his testimony, he explains their approach, quote, when we pulled in, we actually pulled into this area right here, right off the road itself, onto the grassy area. We didn't go any further than that, end quote. So they parked their car near a block concession stand, an old, torn-apart structure located near the ball field. The dispatch indicated a vehicle was east of the ball field by the wooded area. So Kouros and his partner began walking south along the grass path, or the roadway. They were cautious because they didn't know the nature of the crime. Kuros testified, quote, "We approached it with caution because we weren't sure if there was some type of crime we had or what we had going on. It was essentially, we didn't want to disturb anything unnecessarily," end quote. As they walked, they couldn't immediately see the vehicle due to the wooded area obstructing the view from the road. Kuros estimated the car was about 100 to 150 yards from the road, or 300 to 450 feet. When they finally spotted the rear end of the gray vehicle, they approached carefully. Kuros testified, quote, "Myself and Officer Galinas did approach the vehicle, the rear of the vehicle, and once we got to the vehicle, we determined there was nobody in there at the time," end quote. He then radioed dispatch to report the vehicle's location and confirmed that it was empty. Now, this initial focus on the vehicle seems to reflect their uncertainty about the situation, possibly expecting suspects or additional victims inside. But what I find a little strange about this is that the witness testified that he saw a body in the woods. But Kuros' response seems to indicate that the dispatch was only about the car. Now listen as his testimony continues. He gives the impression that finding the bodies was a surprise. He says their attention shifted when Officer Lenter, a park officer already on the scene, reported seeing what appeared to be an arm in the wooded area north of the vehicle. Kuros marked this general area with an X on a diagram he drew during his testimony, describing it as a rough estimate. He said, quote, "That was actually north of the vehicle in the wooded area as well, too," end quote. Leonard was advised by Corporal Galinas not to approach, likely to avoid contaminating the scene. As Kuros and Galinas continued, they noticed a red substance on the ground, which they suspected might be blood. Kuros testified, quote, "It was cold, it was snowy. We did notice there was a red substance on the ground at different spots, which appeared to be blood. But like I said, it was just different, you know. It was a substance at that time. Not sure what it was," end quote. He marked these spots with an R on the diagram. I don't have that diagram, by the way. Now, the red substance was significant enough to warrant further investigation, obviously. Kuros testified, quote, "Actually, before and after we started getting into the path area around the concession stand, it was shortly after that, through that area there, we started seeing spots," end quote. Now, this aligns with Trigg's earlier observation of the blood trail, suggesting a continuity of evidence from the car to the wooded area. During the trial, State's Exhibit 8, a photograph of the red substance on the snow-covered path, was admitted into evidence. Kuros held it up and said, quote, "The photo represents, on the path itself, where we were at, the area of the red substance that was on the snow on the path as we were walking down the path that you could actually see," end quote. The path itself was an important element of the scene. Kuros described it as a grass path running north and south between the ball field and the wooded area, with open grass fields to the west and houses along 14th Street to the northeast. He noted the chain-link fence in the area that I was describing earlier. State's Exhibit 9, another admitted photograph, showed the path and bleachers, with Kuros explaining, quote, "This photograph here again depicts the path that we were actually on in the wooded area. It also depicts where we had actually sealed off the scene to prevent any further traffic from going in and out of there," end quote. He places this just south of the concession stand at the beginning of the path. As they progressed, State's Exhibit 10 offered a view deeper into the scene. Kuros estimated this photograph was taken about 75 yards into the wooded area, showing the dense trees east of the ball field. He said, quote, "This is actually probably an area about 75 yards, I would say, into the area," end quote. When asked about the bodies, he responded, quote, "I believe it was just east of there in the wooded area itself. I'm not sure exactly distance from there," end quote. This is what I meant at the start of the episode regarding confusion and vagueness of the descriptions of the scene in front of the jury. Kuros isn't specific or confident at all in any of his descriptions. Although his role was limited to the initial response and securing the area, he testified, quote, "Other than taking the names of the officers at the scene, we take homicide digests where each individual that comes onto the scene goes into the crime scene itself. We take their names and number, their badge number, and the department they work for, and that was my extent," end quote. He didn't take statements from witnesses or conduct further investigation. That fell outside of his responsibilities. The Kuros' testimony combined with Triggs gives us the foundation for the ballpark discovery. A vacant gray Ford Tempo, a blood trail, and bodies in the wooded area, all observed under snowy, cold conditions in the afternoon. Triggs's account adds the human element of a citizen's perspective. His dog barking and his decision to investigate the car led to the initial sighting, while his choice to leave and report it prompted the police response. Kuros's careful approach, parking near the concession stand, walking the path rather than driving, and noting the red substance, established the crime scene's boundaries. The blood trail, mentioned by both of them, suggests movement, possibly dragging, though neither specifies direction or cause. The exact times, beyond Triggs's 11 to 12 p.m. estimate and Kuros's unspecified arrival, are the only times we get. In the scene's layout, ball field, path, wooded area, and fence, frames the discovery, but the full extent of the bodies and evidence awaited further investigation. And that sets the stage for what happens next. Triggs's call to the police brought Officer Kuros to the ballpark, where he and his partner began to piece together the scene. The limited visibility due to the wooded area and snow leaves some questions open, but the facts, car, blood, bodies, anchor the beginning of a narrative. After the break, we're going to explore the crime scene investigators and medical examiner's testimony to fill in more details. For now, we've got the initial discovery from the eyes of Terrell Triggs Sr. and Officer John Kuros' laying out of the raw evidence as he found it as he arrived first. Hey everybody, Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pre-game podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Life's messy. We're talking spills, stains, pets, and kids. But with Anabay, you never have to stress about messes again. At washablesofas.com, discover Anabay sofas, the only fully machine washable sofas inside and out, starting at just $699. Made with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics, that means fewer stains and more peace of mind. Designed for real life, our sofas feature changeable fabric covers, allowing you to refresh your style anytime. Need flexibility? Our modular design lets you rearrange your sofa effortlessly. Perfect for cozy apartments or spacious homes. Plus, they're earth-friendly and built to last. That's why over 200,000 happy customers have made the switch. Upgrade your space today. Visit washablesofas.com now and bring home a sofa made for life. That's washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
Do you love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. In the first segment, we introduced the ballpark crime scene on 14th and Idaho, where Terrell Trigg Sr. discovered a grim crime scene in the early afternoon on Thursday, February 17th, and Officer John Kuro secured the area. We learned about the gray tempo, the blood trail, and the two bodies in the wooded area, which sets the stage for this deeper investigation. And now it's time to dig into some forensic details and really try to piece this scene together. We're now going to shift to Detective Maruzio Bartosi's crime scene testimony and Dr. Young Kim's medical examiner findings. Again, this is not the final word on this crime scene. This is just what the jury heard at trial. Now, I'm going to break down the scene's layout, evidence, and injuries by referencing trial transcripts. But remember, the full testimonies that I'm working from are posted on our website. I'm just condensing that testimony into hopefully a narrative that makes sense. So now let's get started with the crime scene investigation. Detective Bartosi, who we heard from last week, was a six-year veteran of the Lake County Sheriff's Department. He arrived at the ballpark with a Detective Bursak around 2:30 p.m. after initial officers had cordoned off the area. His testimony was delivered over 2 days at trial. Now, one thing you'll notice about the pictures Bartosi references, if you look at them on our website, is that they just don't give a clear perspective or understanding of this scene. I struggled a lot with this scene because the pictures are all very isolated. A picture of a blood trail, a picture of the car, a picture of a shoe. There are no wide shots that help you piece together where all of these things are or how they fit together. So hopefully the diagrams I've created will help you. Personally, I needed them in order to make heads or tail of any of this mess. Now let's start with the car. Bartosi notes that the car is parked on top of a pile of shingles. The shingles in the concrete pile where the bodies were found were the result of the old concession stand being torn down. He notes that the shingles were under and behind the back of the car. And he points out that there's a red stain on one of the shingles. If you read the transcript, you'll notice that he's very careful in his testimony. He only answers the questions that are asked of him, and he doesn't do much inferring or hypothesizing. That's nice because he stays factually accurate, but it's also limiting because the prosecutor isn't digging deep into anything. The red stain on the shingles is a perfect example. I can see in the pictures that it's most obviously blood, but the prosecutor never asks if it is. It's just left hanging there as a red stain. Now, the car was pulled up into the tree line facing into the woods, which would be east. The surrounding area was a snow-covered field with patches of bare ground where the snow had melted, which made evidence preservation pretty difficult. Although given the amount of snow on the ground, it's extremely frustrating that we don't have a breakdown or close-up photos of any of the footprints. But the prints were discussed. From the transcript, quote, "Did you find footprints?" "There were footprints within the area leading up to the bodies. You recall two sets? "I can't recall." "Several sets?" "There were several sets." "Several sets. You say several. Is that three sets, 4 sets, 5 sets? What it appeared as we walked down to from the roadway to where the victims were, you seen an apparent blood trail. Along that trail, you seen sets of prints. Could have been two or three. You could not make it out because they were walked on top of each other. So it was no real way to tell. Along the outside, a little bit further off where the trail was, there was additional trail of footprints. Could you tell whether they were female or male prints? You could not tell. Could you tell whether they were prints made by shoes or made by boots? The condition of the snow with everything and temperature, no, you could not. It was warming up. Everything was starting to melt. It was really deteriorating quick. end quote. So it sounds like there was a lot of footprints in the snow going from the car to the bodies and back, some walking on top of each other. Potosi says they were unable to tell how many there were, if they were male or female. Of course, the prosecutor never asked the question, which you'll find out later is very relevant, were any of them from someone who was barefoot? But according to Bertosi, you really couldn't make heads or tails of all the prints. There was too many of them, and the snow was starting to melt. And we just have to take his word for it because we don't have close-up photos of any of these footprints. Now, the blood trail is an obvious critical element of the scene. It's documented in Exhibits 80 through 87. In trial, Bertosi described its path, quote, "The trail starts near the roadway with a concentrated red stain, then progresses southward toward the wooded area," end quote. And here's where Bertosi and the prosecutor just, in my opinion, just absolutely shit the bed. What you have to understand is that there is an isolated pool of blood way back near the dugout. Now, the car was found about 100 feet south of there, with no blood trail connecting the two. Then the actual blood trail they're talking about runs from the car to the bodies in the woods. But at trial, the prosecutor is trying to connect the blood trail that ends at the bodies back to the pool of blood by the dugout. But they don't actually connect. They're nowhere near each other, in fact. Let me read you this exchange from trial so you can get a good feeling of how confusing this was for the jurors. From the transcript, quote, "The victim was located, the victim's head was approximately 76 feet south of the dugout. And that's where you saw blood at the dugout? Did you see blood? There was blood approximately 17 feet north of the south edge of the dugout. So it's your conclusion that the body may have been dragged approximately 147 feet? Is that what you concluded, that the body was dragged or perhaps dragged 17 feet? No, sir. Are you able to give any estimate at all of the apparent distance that one body was dragged from one spot to the other? No. Do you have any approximation? More than 50 yards? Less than 50 yards? No, sir, I cannot." End quote. So did you get all that? Of course not, because it's nonsense. Especially if you look at the diagram, you'll see how much nonsense it is. I don't know why Bertosi didn't just clear this up. He could have simply answered that the blood trail doesn't connect to the dugout, it runs from the car to the bodies. I'll explain all this in detail when I give you my theory, but I can only imagine that the jury was completely baffled at this point. Body positions and drag marks should have made things clear for the juries and for us. Unfortunately, Bertosi's testimony just confuses the issue even further. I think it's more the prosecutor's fault than Bertosi's, though. Like I said earlier, he's not asking the right questions, and Bertosi is very careful to only answer what's been asked of him. He rarely provides any extra details. It also doesn't help that the crime scene photos, again, aren't taken in a way to provide any kind of big picture perspective. So in order not to confuse you, I'm going to break format here and just tell you what the actual evidence shows us about the body positions, conditions, and injuries. You can read how Bertosi describes it in the transcript, but I think you'll find that he's so vague it's not really helpful at all. So the rest of the information I'm going to give you here comes from the written reports and the crime scene photos, not from Bertosi's testimony. But this is what the crime scene actually looked like. Elizabeth Ayers was discovered partially clothed. She was wearing jeans, socks, shoes, and a bra. She was not wearing a shirt. Her body was oriented face down with bad drag marks visible all along her back, indicating that she was attacked and likely incapacitated prior to being dragged to her final resting place. Sheila Barty was found fully nude. Even her socks were missing. Head to toe, she was completely disrobed. Her body was positioned on her back, and she was laying across the bottom half of Liz's legs. There was clothing scattered around the pile of concrete chunks where they were found, like they had been tossed up on them after they were killed. Now, working backwards from the bodies, the scene spreads out in two directions. There were two socks found between the bodies and the roadway, presumably Sheila's, that were found north of the bodies, so back towards the dugout, while the bloody drag marks go south back to the car. There was also a shoe found in the middle of the roadway about halfway between the bodies and the dugout. So again, the opposite direction of the car and where the drag marks led. There were a pair of sunglasses found near the shoe. And again, although Bertosi makes no inferences as to who the shoe belongs to, A fair assumption would be that it belonged to Sheila. The shoe's match was found on the other side of the fence in the baseball field, and it appears to have been thrown there. You look at the crime scene photos prior to the investigators walking up to it, there are no footprints anywhere near that shoe. And again, I highly recommend going to our website and looking at the diagram to make sense of all this. There's also a pool of blood that I mentioned earlier in the roadway way back by the dugout. So all of that stuff is north and west of the bodies. Then we have the bloody trail that leads south from the bodies back to the area near the car. It's not specified how close it comes to the car, but we do have that bloodstained shingle right behind it. So now let me recap that because I know it's a lot to take in and it's confusing. Here are all the significant pieces of evidence found at the scene as you move south from home plate along the fence line. The first thing you're going to come to is the pool of blood on the roadway next to the dugout. As you continue south, you come to a left shoe in the roadway and a pair of sunglasses. A few steps further to the south, and then you're parallel to the right shoe that's on the other side of the fence in the ball field to the west. Keep going south a few more steps and you'd be parallel to a sock that's several feet into the woods to the east. A few feet further to the south and the other sock is right there also in the woods. The bodies are next as you move south, but let's move past them for now. If you stay on the roadway for another 50 feet or so, you come to the car. It's pulled off the road into the wood line, so it's not visible until you get quite a ways back. At the car, you find a pile of shingles, and one of the shingles has apparent blood on it. There is no blood in the car at all. Now, if you look back to the north, you'll see a bloody trail in the snow that goes northeast into the woods. If you follow the blood trail, you end up at a pile of concrete where the bodies rest along with the victim's clothing scattered around. And there were no weapons found at the crime scene. Now, while that still may be confusing, I can say with confidence that you now have a much clearer picture of that crime scene than the jury did. Let's shift now to the medical evidence. Dr. Young Kim, the same pathologist who performed the autopsies on the triple homicide victims last week, conducted autopsies on February 17th and 18th of Liz and Sheila. Just to give you a heads up, you might notice that when I quote Dr. Kim, it is very apparent that English is not his first language. Just know I'm just reading the transcript exactly how it's written. For Sheila Barty, Dr. Kim determined the cause of death is a single gunshot wound to the head, testifying, quote, "You can see the one gunshot wound right side of back of head. This bullet fractured the skull, lacerate the brain," end quote. He also noted, quote, "I found the jacket and two piece of projectile recovered," end quote, which means the bullet broke apart but did not exit. He observed no significant markings around the entry wound. From the transcript, quote, question, "The nature of the entry wound, was there anything that you noted significant to that entry wound?" Answer, "No, ma'am," end quote. So there was no stippling or muzzle marks on Sheila's head. And Dr. Kim deferred to a firearms expert for any distance estimations. Quote, question, "Can you quantify in that terms of feet or anything like that?" Answer, "No, you can ask firearm expert, they give you," end quote. Kim did not comment on the bullet's trajectory or Sheila's position at the time of being shot. So that's Sheila. Remember, she was found completely nude and her body was discovered laid across the back of Liz's legs per the crime scene photos. A single gunshot wound to the back of her head with no close range indicators suggesting it was fired from at least a few feet away. Given her position on top of Liz's body and the single wound, I think it's safe to say she was likely killed last and was not the one dragged from the car to the concrete pile. Not only because there are obvious drag marks on Liz's body, but also because the scene seems to indicate that she was found right where she was shot. For Liz Ayers, Dr. Kim established the cause of death as gunshot wounds to the head and chest along with blunt head trauma, testifying, quote, "gunshot wound of head and the chest, also there was blunt head injury," end quote. Here's his testimony regarding the shot to the chest. Quote, question, "What was the path of that particular projectile?" Answer, "front to the back." "And what injuries did that bullet cause?" Answer, "injury to the lung, right side of the lung coming out the back," end quote. Goes on to say, quote, this case, Stippling was present in the gunshot wound. Question, what does that tell you? Answer, Stippling indicate gun was shot at close range, end quote. He also detailed the blunt force trauma, saying, quote, a large laceration top of head, laceration below extensive fracture of the skull, end quote. And he described the skull fracture as oval-shaped, quote, about 1 inch by 1 3/4 inch in diameter, end quote. Dr. Kim was able to recover a small piece of the bullet inside of Liz's head. He also highlighted the drag marks on her back. One thing to note for later is the path of the gunshot wound to Liz's chest. Kim describes it as having an outward and downward trajectory. While not a certainty, this is indicative of Liz being in a seated or kneeling position when she was shot in the chest from above. So that's the basic layout of this extremely complex crime scene. I've been racking my brain all week to try to piece it together, and after this break, I'll deliver my personal hypothesis.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Time for a sofa upgrade? Visit washablesofas.com and discover Anabay, where designer style meets budget-friendly prices, with sofas starting at $699. Anabay brings you the ultimate in furniture innovation with a modular design that allows you to rearrange your space effortlessly. Perfect for both small and large spaces, Anabay is the only machine-washable sofa inside and out. Say goodbye to stains and messes with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics that make cleaning easy. Liquid simply slides right off. Designed for custom comfort, our high-resilience foam lets you choose between a sink and feel or a supportive memory foam blend. Plus, our pet-friendly, stain-resistant fabrics ensure your sofa stays beautiful for years. Don't compromise quality for price. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your living space today with no-risk returns and a 30-day money-back guarantee. Get up to 60% off plus free shipping and free returns. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
Do you love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.
When I first looked through the photos from the scene and read Bertozzi and Kim's testimonies, I saw a complexly disorganized crime scene that frankly didn't make sense to me. It looked like the offenders pulled up to the ball field with the women. Maybe there was a sexual assault. Maybe something that began as consensual started. Things broke bad. Liz and Sheila were shot and their bodies were dragged into the woods and the offenders fled on foot. I was honestly perplexed. I had so many questions. Why is Sheila nude? Why was Liz dragged? Why go through the trouble of moving the bodies when the car is just out in the open? Why the hell is there a shoe in the middle of the baseball field? But after digging deeper, I realized that nothing was really as it appeared in the photos and Bertozzi's testimony. The close-up pictures made it impossible to get perspective. His distances delivered from the stand were just numbers. Until I took the time to plot everything out on a diagram, and then it started to come together for me. The first thing I did was to break this crime scene down into three separate crime scenes. You have the pool of blood back by the dugout, which is visible from 14th Street. Then you have the car that's around 100 feet south of there, pulled back into the wood line. We have that blood stain on the shingle near the car. Then we have the final resting place of the bodies and the pile of concrete in the woods. Once I broke things down into these three areas, the next step was to connect the dots. Getting from the car to the bodies was easy. We have that blood trail in the snow. But the pool of blood by the dugout is more difficult to make sense of. It doesn't connect to anything. There's no blood trail or footprints in the snow connecting it to the bodies in the woods. There's also no blood trail connecting it to the car. So what does that pool of blood indicate? I think that it indicates that the violence began at that spot, right next to the dugout. Someone was clearly injured there and was bleeding profusely. And since Sheila only has the single gunshot wound to the head and no drag marks, my conclusion is that it was Liz. Liz had two injuries that definitely were life-threatening, but neither would kill her immediately. The blunt force wound to her head and the gunshot to the chest that punctured one lung. Despite what's depicted in the movies, a gunshot wound to the chest that only injures one of the lungs does not result in instant death. In fact, it could take minutes to even hours to die from a wound like that. Same with the head wound. Her skull was fractured and her brain was bleeding, but again, it would take time for that wound to end her life. But back to the basics of the dot connecting, how did Liz, who would have been bleeding badly from either of those wounds, get from the dugout to the car where the drag trail begins? We have about 100 feet of ground between the pool of blood and the car with no evidence of dragging or even walking for that matter between the two. To me, that can only mean one thing. She was moved in a vehicle. She was either hit over the head or shot back by the dugout, and the offender put her in a vehicle and drove her back to where the car was found, to an area that wasn't visible from the street, or more importantly, from the houses across the street. So now I have the dots connected. Attack starts by the dugout. Liz is either shot or hit over the head or both. She's bleeding. She's loaded into a vehicle and moved back to the area where the tempo was found. There, she was taken out of the vehicle where she bled on the shingles. She was dragged back to the pile of concrete in the woods. Point A to point B to point C. But what about Sheila? Since she only suffered a single fatal gunshot wound to the head, I have to assume that she was forced to follow along, most likely at gunpoint. Digging a little deeper, let's look at the car Liz was driving. There wasn't a drop of blood found in the car. None. So what does that tell me? It tells me there had to be a second vehicle. Liz was bleeding and had to be transported from the dugout to the area where the car was found, and she most certainly wasn't moved in the tempo or we'd find blood inside. When you combine that with Sheila ending up at the concrete pile without being dragged, and I've concluded that there had to be at least two offenders. Possibly more, but at least two. Two cars had to be moved, and someone most likely had to hold Sheila at gunpoint while someone else dragged Liz's unconscious body into the woods. So now the picture is starting to get clearer. But what about the clothes and the shoes? I think they offer a really good clue as to where Sheila was disrobed. The majority of the clothes were tossed onto the concrete pile by the bodies. Now there's no telling when or how they got there, but the socks and shoes shed some light. The socks are found between the bodies and the dugout, in the woods, with no visible footprints connecting them. That tells me that they were thrown there, and they were thrown there from the direction of the dugout. The offenders wouldn't approach the bodies from the direction of the car with the socks, only then to throw them several feet beyond the bodies. It only makes sense that they were tossed from the roadway from the other direction. Now, the shoe in the roadway doesn't tell us much, but the shoe in the baseball field on the other side of the fence, I think, tells us a lot. From what I see in those pictures, there is only one way for that shoe to have gotten there. It was tossed and tossed haphazardly, probably with a wide swinging motion, and the thrower missed their mark. I think they probably released the shoe too late, and it sailed wide right into the field rather than going left into the woods, which was probably their intention. So let me put all this together into a hypothetical narrative. This is my best hypothesis at this point. I think Liz and Sheila were at the dugout with multiple men. Obviously, there was something sexual in nature going on there, but at this point, it's impossible to know if whatever was going on began as consensual or not. I can only speculate. But whatever was happening broke bad. Sheila either took her clothes off or they were taken off of her at the dugout, all the way down to and including her socks. And that detail alone makes me lean towards this beginning with a sexual assault. It's an odd detail and it's really just kind of a hunch, but if the two victims for some reason went to the baseball dugout to have consensual sex outside in the winter, two women who didn't know each other before this night, by the way, for some reason it just doesn't feel right to me that Sheila would have removed her socks. To be clear, like I said, that's total speculation, but this just feels forced to me. I think Liz's shirt is removed, and then she makes a run for it, also adding to my hunch about this being a sexual assault from the very beginning. I don't think that you go through the trouble of driving off the road to a dugout for sex only to do it in the middle of the driveway. I'm making assumption, but my hypothesis, I'm going to assume that the sex, or more likely in my opinion, sexual assault, was happening in the dugout, where there was some privacy. And I think Liz tried to get away, took off, made it to the roadway by the dugout, was either shot or hit over the head with the handle of a pistol, or both. Now I say pistol because the 1-inch by 1.5-inch oval-shaped fracture to her skull could be a lot of things, but those are the dimensions at the bottom of the handles of a lot of .38-caliber pistols. This could really go either way, but if I had to guess, based on the trajectory of the gunshot to the chest that I'll explain in a minute, I think she's hit over the head at this point, which opens up a massive bleeding wound. Now, this is when I think the offenders realize they're in trouble. They've inflicted a life-threatening wound to Liz. And their actions from this point forward, to me, indicate that someone knows they are with these women. I say this because they didn't just kill them both to eliminate witnesses. They took serious risk and spent time and effort to conceal the bodies and the crime itself. It's not permanent concealment and wasn't meant to be, but it was definitely an attempt to buy themselves some time. I think they loaded the women up into their vehicle and drove both vehicles back far enough so that the tempo wouldn't be seen by casual passersby on the street or by the people living in the houses across 14th. They pulled the car as far into the wood line as they could to conceal it, and they forced Liz and Sheila out. At this point, Sheila is fully nude, and at the very least, her shoes and socks are still back at the dugout. Liz is in bad shape and bleeding. I believe that the offenders attempt to force the women to walk back into the woods, but Liz physically can't. I said it's hard to say when she's shot in the chest. The downward trajectory of the shot makes me think that she might have been on her knees due to the head injury, and the offender shot her out of frustration and/or as a way to intimidate Sheila into complying. It's also possible that Liz was both shot and hit on the head back at the dugout, but I really don't think that's where the shooting started. It's just too risky to spend this much time concealing the bodies after they've already fired a shot, outside where it can be heard by anyone. But one way or another, Sheila is forced back into the woods at gunpoint by one offender, while another offender drags Liz behind. Like I keep saying, I don't know and can't speculate on when the shot to the chest happens. Could have been back at the car, or it could have been back at the concrete pile. Either way, Liz is unable to move when she's dragged into the pile. The way the two bodies are situated, it looks to me like Sheila was probably standing over Liz, probably looking and in shock when she was shot in the back of the head. She falls down on top of Liz's legs. Then the gun is pressed to the back of Liz's head and fired, making sure she's dead. I want to be clear that the sequence of those shots is purely hypothesis, based on the evidence, but not in any way proven. There are a lot of different ways this could have gone down. The important part of the sequence for us at this point is what comes next. The women's clothing was all tossed onto the pile. There's no path to the pile from the direction of the dugout, which means the pants, shirts, jacket were carried there from the cars. I think that indicates that the offenders had the wherewithal back at the dugout where the violence began to quickly gather up the clothes before they move the women to the cars. And then comes the socks and shoes. Now, at this point, the killers have fired 3 shots outdoors right across the street from several houses. They had to assume that someone would have heard and alerted police, and someone did. Remember, we talked about that in episode 1. So they're in a hurry to get out of there, and I believe that on the way out, they come across the items they missed back by the dugout. Sheila's shoes and socks. They don't want to leave anything behind up by the dugout that could alert anyone to the scene they left in the woods. It's my theory that on the way out, they grabbed the socks, ran up and tossed them back into the woods, and grabbed the shoes and chucked them, and rushed out of there. So why is this so important? Because if I'm right, and some version of this sequence is what actually happened, it means that you have an unplanned double homicide. They wouldn't stop at the dugout if the offenders had murder in mind. They would have went straight to the back of the property. After the violence began, the offenders spent time, effort, and risk to not only eliminate a witness, Sheila, and make sure Liz died so she couldn't be a witness to her own attack, but they also put effort into temporarily concealing their crime. The only reason they would have made that kind of effort, knowing full well that the bodies would eventually be discovered, would be because someone knew that they were with Liz and Sheila that night. And given everything we know about this case up to this point, I think there's a really good chance that the reason they just needed to buy themselves time is because they plan to go back and eliminate those other witnesses. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney. And Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Life's messy. We're talking spills, stains, pets, and kids. But with Anna Bay, you never have to stress about messes again. At washablesofas.com, discover Anabe sofas, the only fully machine washable sofas inside and out, starting at just $699. Made with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics, that means fewer stains and more peace of mind. Designed for real life, our sofas feature changeable fabric covers, allowing you to refresh your style anytime. Need flexibility? Our modular design lets you rearrange your sofa effortlessly. Perfect for cozy apartments or spacious homes. Plus, they're earth-friendly and built to last. That's why over 200,000 happy customers have made the switch. Upgrade your space today. Visit washablesofas.com now and bring home a sofa made for life. That's washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
Do you love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.